Mostly nightmares? Yeah, and this is interesting where you can, people debate whether you can classify what happens in Daniel 2 as a nightmare, a vision, or a dream, or what's all going on. It seems like it's a nightmare to some degree. It causes insomnia. And we'll look at that. And it's interesting, when you and I think about our dreams, I don't know if you sit around your table and talk about what you dreamt that night, but we've got kids, and sometimes they're like, I had this dream. And people are very uninterested in each other's dreams. Have you ever noticed this? Like, you can be, like, excited. I had this dream. It was really weird. People are like, I don't really care. Like, it's hard to muster the excitement every morning to hear about your daughter's dream, that you're like, I'm speculative of how much of this is actually a dream and how much of this you just started making up on the fly. And so we're skeptical of dreams, aren't we? And yet when we come to a book like Daniel, we're instructed to take this dream of this king very seriously, something that forms us and even shapes our understanding of the world through this dream. So we got to take that into consideration. I know we talked about some of the introductory stuff in Daniel last week, and we're going to cover just a few things just to get us up to speed again, right? Daniel is written in a time of exile. God's people are in exile. That's why we've got this up here. And that's, if you can see that little red line, that's their path to exile. And so Daniel begins, and especially in the chapter today, it begins in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, which is about 604 BC. And so this is before Jerusalem has been totally annihilated by the Babylonians, but they've had a series of sieges. In 605, they came and sieged the city, and they took, we saw in chapter 1, the gold out of the temple and took it back into the temple of their god. So they took the gold out of Yahweh's temple and moved it to their temple. And that's significant, really, for the rest of the book. It's a symbol that not all is right in Israel, in Judah. Things are going poorly. And on top of that, it's a question of who's in charge, right? Here's God's people who have been given a covenant, a promise, and now their temple, the things in their temple, have been removed. They've been moved over to Babylon all the way down to the capital, which is the city of Babylon. And so understandably, there's a bit of an existential crisis going on in the people. Who are we? Do we still have a place in this world? And that's really the theme that we'll see in chapter 2. Daniel, right, is sort of one of the first people to go into exile. When nations would come and sort of take you over, one of the first things they do is they would take your sort of upper crust, your rulers, your up-and-coming people, and say, hey, you're gonna come and you're going to live in Babylon, and we're going to make you Babylonians. It was a cultural assimilation project, and Daniel is a part of that. And last week, we saw him resisting some of that, right? In chapter 1, we saw him being offered to eat this food, and then he says, I'm not going to do that. And Daniel became, think about this for a moment. Daniel, as we read through chapter 1, becomes a very unpopular person among these trainees, right? You've got people who are in charge this program for 3 years, and then they find out they're going to have to eat vegetables, right? Why? Because of this Daniel guy. I don't know if you noticed that in the text last week, right? And so arguably Daniel is not particularly, they didn't sign up. They signed up for the luxury of the king's table. Right, and instead they're being given vegetables and water. So Daniel does that. And the issue there in that moment actually, I think, helps us understand the book of Daniel, because it's not just that those food on the king's table could have been sacrificed to idols. That's sometimes how we read that. But the vegetables also would have been sacrificed to idols. So it seems that maybe what's going on there is Daniel is saying, this is a tempting place to be, sitting in the seat of power in Babylon, being trained to be part of the Babylonian sort of bureaucracy, being trained and offered all of the luxuries of the kingdom. And so Daniel intentionally sort of protects himself from that. And that'll be a theme throughout the book of Daniel, sort of this in the world but not of it dynamic, this I don't want to assimilate into the world, and yet I need to be here for the good of these people. And really, that's some context, kind of enough to say before we get into chapter 2. Another thing just to note as we read through this book is application in Daniel is always a little bit tricky, right? I don't know if there's a song, but the line, dare to be a Daniel, right? Are you guys familiar with that? I don't know if that's a song. If it is, you can, it is? Okay. Yeah. I can't remember that. Maybe because
it's a kid's song.
Yeah, right. And that's a, should we dare to be a Daniel? Yeah, there are lots of ways that Daniel is very commendable in the text. He stands against evil. He is not afraid, we'll see in this text, to to go into places that most of us would say, hey, there's probably an easier way to get through this situation. I can just fit in rather than resist. And so that's not inappropriate, and yet it's very obvious as we read the text that there's a bigger hero. I think Luke used that word last week, a bigger hero in the story, and that's God. The big picture behind this is, whose God is in charge? Is it the God of the Babylonians, or is it Yahweh, the God of Israel, who is in charge? And so as we read it, we'll see both of those things. The only way Daniel can be a hero is because his God is stronger. It's not Daniel in his own self that is being sort of helpful in these situations. It's God working through him. All right, that's our quick intro so we can dive into the specifics of our chapter today. Anything else that you want to highlight, things that you saw last week, things you note about the book of Daniel before we read some text together? All right, let's dive in. We're going to take kind of just a chunk at a time and read through it, and partially so we experience the text together. And what I mean by that is stories like Daniel, maybe we're very familiar with, and we kind of know, we could probably jot down the application of this sermon at the end, or this passage at the end, but to see it, we need to slow down and kind of walk through it as Daniel and a first hearer of the text would do. So let's look at verses 1 through 16. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. Then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, The word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation. They answered a second time and said, Let the king tell his servant the dream, and we will show its interpretation. The king answered and said, I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time because you see the word from me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, There is no man on earth who can meet the king's demand, for no greater and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. All right, let's stop there. So we have a problem, right? We have a king with insomnia who has this dream, and he's troubled, right? It's the early part of his kingdom. He's just taken over for his father, and there's a lot of pressures going on in this day. A couple of years before that, he had a really successful campaign that pushed sort of the Babylonian Empire, as we see, all the way down towards Egypt. And he'd like to get down there and sort of push it, but he also has the Median Empire sort of pressing in on him. And so he's got a lot of concerns. Am I going to be adequate to take over after my father? And so he has this dream that troubles him. And the story, as you see it there, is he wants somebody to tell him what it means. But he has a caveat, right? Not only does he want the interpretation, but he wants you to actually tell him what it was. And the answer seems pretty obvious why he wants that, right? To prove that these guys actually are able to interpret the vision. Because if you think about it, it's pretty easy to interpret a dream, right? You can interpret it as anything you want, right? And in this day, they actually would have, we can call them sort of dream catalog books, right? And so they would go, and it wasn't just like they sat there and like did some incense or something. They would go to the library and do some research, right? All right. This time of year, this type of dream, what could it mean? That was their approach. It was loosely scientific, we could say, right? They had a process by which they would go and interpret the dreams. And this King Nebuchadnezzar, for some reason, is suspicious of that, right? And there's all kinds of political intrigue going on behind the scenes, but it makes sense that he would have some suspicions that these people who may have worked for his father, may have worked for a rival, all of these sort of people that he lists there, magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and Chaldeans, are summoned by the king to tell him his dream. And those people, they're very sort of an official sort of guild of people. And they could, depending on how the dream went, they could help you with the solution too, right? If the problem was another country, the sorcerers could cast a curse on them. The enchanters are sort of medical, right? So if it was a dream of an omen against you, you could maybe get some medical assistance. The Chaldeans are really just sort of the leaders of the whole group. And the magicians could also help out in various ways as well. And so this is the situation that Daniel finds himself in. And it's a very, it's a pagan situation. This one might be a little less focused, but this is Babylon as best as we can tell, or as we know it in this day. And Daniel would have been somewhere in the center there. There's a ziggurat, which is sort of the place where they would have lived and done a lot of their things. But if you look at this a little closer, one of the things you'll notice is that all of the sort of little squares all over the place, those are temples, right? So Babylon is a highly religious place. And what's interesting is there are multiple temples to the same gods as you look at it. Some gods have more than one temple in the city of Babylon, right? So this is a place that is concerned with the gods, concerned with all of those sorts of things. And the fact that this king sees his dream as something that is potentially of the gods and requires, you know, divining in terms of its meaning shows that they are very much thinking in terms of who is in charge and who is the god who is in control of all things and how can I make sure that they are sort of on my side and not on somebody else's side. What do you guys notice? What else do you notice in this passage? Yeah.
Well, I've always been curious as to why the Chaldeans answered him in Aramaic.
Yeah.
What is that?
So the answer, that's a good question. And actually, at this point, the book of Daniel is actually written in Aramaic all the way till chapter 7. And there's, we'll get into that as we go on. There's actually some really intentional things that are going on there. Aramaic is sort of the language of the realm in this day, sort of like Greek will become later on. And so, I mean, Jesus would have spoken Aramaic. That this language exists for quite a while in this context. And so the point mainly is that they are speaking in the language of the realm. That's what that is. And it carries on through the rest of the book. As it says Aramaic, it switches into Aramaic. And it, chapter 4 and 5 will show us that these sort of, maybe the author is trying to do something structurally there, but it's not a hugely significant point other than to remind us that this is a book written a very specific time and place, and the language reflects that.
And the ziggurat, is this the same ziggurat in Genesis? No.
That one would have been long gone. Ziggurats are fairly common, but Babylonian, Assyrian kind of things were common here. There's a lot of archaeological stuff you can go into to do this. And that actually reminds me, you've probably seen the Ishtar Gate. It's this, if you think of Babylon and you've looked at a book, it's this blue gate, right? That's sort of blue stones and has all these dragons and fantastic creatures on. And you can go to Berlin. Has anybody seen it? You seen it in Berlin? Okay. It's in Berlin. They've
it's in the Pergamon Museum.
Yeah.
And they actually have, it's a double gate, and mm-hmm. there's not room for the bigger one.
Yeah.
So they only have the smaller one,
yeah.
which is like three stories
yeah.
high, and it has the whole thing. It's
yeah.
my favorite museum.
Yeah.
Anywhere I've ever been. And I have to go in and see the
yeah.
Ishtar Gate because it's like, wait, this is really the
yeah.
Ishtar Gate.
Yeah, which is really fascinating. They literally just took it brick by brick, and apparently they had to like fix a couple bricks here and there, but they took it brick by brick and moved it to the museum. And what's cool about that is very historically, like Daniel saw that, right? Daniel walked through that. There's no, yeah.
The other thing is that the Babylonians themselves had numbered the bricks.
Yes.
So the Germans, when they got it, didn't even have to do it. They just had to put it all down.
That's cool. Yeah. So again, this is one of those cool things where it's like this is a time and place, right? And we could go on and on about the archaeology and these kind of things, but it is fascinating. This is a impressive city, right? Daniel walks in and he says, I mean, he's sad to be there, right? Because he's a captive. But at the same time, it's like this is the seat of power. This is wealth. This is security. And he's being trained to be a leader within this world. All right. And those are kind of form some of the questions we need to ask about how we assimilate into this. Other things we note here. So the king has made this demand. how are you, you're a magician and you're told to do this. What do you think? Kind of sunk, right? Yeah, kill me now, right? And that, and there is this like sentence, right? It's like, my word is firm, right? There's this sense that there is no way out. And literally, what's the penalty? Dismemberment is how we would translate that, rip limb from limb. What's interesting is the king seems to say that, and it is the threat. Later in the text, it'll seem like he kind of wants to give them some time. Like, it's not ideal to sort of wipe out all your magicians, right? That's a bad political move. But if they can't do what they say they can do, then what good are they? That's also the logic there. But catch verse 11. Verse 11 is important as you read this. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods. His dwelling is not with flesh. Point being, we need a god to do this, and we don't have access to the gods. They're not here. So it's an interesting admission on their part. It's not that they can go and have the gods sort of do what they want. And really, that's setting up what comes, right? Their God can't, but Yahweh can. The God of Judah, the God of God's people, can.
So, Kevin, yeah. Were they worshiping a lot of different gods like Egypt?
Yeah. Yeah, they would have a pantheon of gods, a whole collection of them. And that'll actually come up later when Nebuchadnezzar sort of worships at the end of this. It's probable that he's just adding it into the other ones. He's not saying like, oh, okay, that you're the only God. He's saying, sure, we could put a temple in for you too. Right?
Okay, so all those temples, are those the unique gods?
Yes, so there's Ishtar, there's Marduk, Ishara, and we could keep going, but there's, you know, they have a whole hierarchy of gods. Ishtar being kind of up there on the chart. Yeah, and that's an interesting thing. That's a normal worldview for people to have in that day. It's normal, and God's people, even to a degree, they don't look at these dreams and these magicians and say, that's all just superstition. There's an awareness that sometimes they think that stuff works. There's comfortability with that. And it's not endorsed in Scripture, right? Scripture actually says we shouldn't do that. But those are the normal things that people would have trusted in their day. Just like we trust our 401ks, they would trust the local temple and the sacrificial system to sort of secure their future, right? And so there's an analogous sort of idolatry, possibly, we could read into that situation as well. All right, so we're primed to expect God to do something. A bit of a problem here. Who's going to give up first? How bad will the violence be? These are all things that are kind of in the text. And what happens in verse 12? Because of this, the king was angry and very furious and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard. Also, you could call him just the executioner, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, "Why is this the decree of the king so urgent?" Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel, and Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. Now, kind of cool. I mean, as expected, the death sentence is sort of sent out. But you also note that Daniel is lumped in with all these other people. There's a question of chronology here, exactly when this happens. And people vary on it, how to fit in Daniel's training period and this event, how they fit together. It's probable that Daniel is still in training, in the three-year training period when this happens, but he's part of the sort of the guild, and so he's guilty because because the guild can't give the answer to the king. And so this named Arioch guy, he's in charge of the Babylonian execution process, and so he ensues to do this, and Daniel goes to him, right? Which is arguably kind of a bold move. He's like, he's supposed to kill me, but by the way, I'm just going to show up and say, by the way, can I have some time with the king? I can tell the matter to the king. Now, it's interesting, Daniel, you know, he plays the politics here a little bit. He's wise. It says he is what? Prudent and discerning, right? He sees the situation, and he wants to sort of understand more of it. And so he's wise. And there's something, I mean, we could apply that in a sense, right? In moments of crisis, how do you respond? Daniel's an example here, in a sense. Verse 16 is interesting, though. He goes and he says that he's going to tell the king the dream. Now, Daniel doesn't know the interpretation, right? At this point, Daniel doesn't know. We'll see that in just a few verses, right? So he's going to the king and say, hey, I got it, right? That's functionally what Daniel's doing. And that's sort of remarkable. Daniel makes a deal. I want to get on his calendar. I can handle this. And so Arioch is amenable to that, as we'll see in a minute. But the question for us is, in this moment, what do we do? Right? If we can just sort of not anticipate everything that Daniel's going to do, what do you do in a moment like this? I know it's a little contrived. You're like, I've never been in a situation where I have to interpret a dream. But the question, or die, right? But the question sort of is when the bottom sort of drops out of our lives, what's our impulse? Right? What do we do?
Panic.
Yeah. Does Daniel panic?
No.
Yeah. I mean, we're not privy to everything. I'm sure his stomach fell to some degree. But yeah, there isn't a sense of panic.
Like he was buying time.
Buying time. Yeah.
What has he got to lose?
Gonna die anyways.
Yeah. But he's confident that God's.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll see that very, very quickly that there's a confidence in God.
Yeah.
Yeah. What did you say again, Dave?
Buying time.
Buying time. Yeah. Yeah, and I think that it is interesting. And so his first move is say, hey, let's stall this, right? Let's sort of grind the political bureaucracy gears a little bit. Let's get a date on the calendar, and maybe that'll spare bias some time. Like, he is playing for time. And then the next question is, what do you do with the time that you bought? And that's where we go in this text. Because most of us would say, hey, I'm going to buy for time. I'm going to get the meeting. I got 2 weeks to sort this out. Let's go look at some astrology books. Let's go look at the stock market. Let's go see what I can sell to solve my problem, that sort of thing. But what does Daniel do? Let's pick up in verse 17. Then Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as they'll be called, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So there you see it. Daniel didn't have a plan other than to what? Pray. To seek mercy. And I think it's the obvious move, right? We say, of course he went and prayed. But note in our own proclivities to do anything but pray in a moment of crisis, right? We want to plan. We want to get ourselves out of it. And it's interesting. Daniel's not passive. I think that's helpful to see. He's not passive. He doesn't just go and pray. He gets the meeting and he prays, right? There's action, but there's also this sense of, it's a mystery. It says it right there in verse 18, this mystery. And that word mystery is going to come up again in the book of Daniel's and God, book of Daniel, and God is the revealer of mysteries, the only one who reveals mysteries. And Daniel knows that. It's almost a title in the book of Daniel, that God is a revealer of mysteries. Also interesting that he cares about the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Anybody have a problem with that?
No. I mean, he values human life.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody's created in God's image.
Yeah. I didn't have a chance to read it fully, but John Calvin has a section in his commentary on Daniel where he, like, wrestles with this. Because he doesn't really like the fact that Daniel spares the other people. He's like, maybe Daniel could have come up with a way to, like, have them all wiped out and that kind of thing, right? Pardon?
He's kind of a Jonah.
Fair enough. Just an interesting note in the text, but I think, Mary Jane, your point of valuing human life is right, and wanting people to see the goodness of God, it may be behind his motivation.
And maybe some of those wise men came to faith.
It's possible. Yeah, it's possible if we don't have a record, but we do.
Well, if you don't have wise counselors, then the community's not going to do well. I mean,
yeah.
They were charged with making sure that things prospered in Babylon. That was part of their charge from the Lord, is, you know,
yes,
have families and live in Babylon and prosper where you are.
Yep.
And if he'd allowed it to be destroyed, it would have basically just been selfish, and it wouldn't have been. I don't think it would have been a real problem. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it would have put a massive moment of crisis, right? I mean, like, you could argue, if you wipe out all the bureaucracy here, which is sort of the magicians, the chanters, like, they're not just, like, sitting there doing spells, they're actually running the country as well, right? If you get rid of all of them, that's going to cause, as you're saying.
Well, it's God's job,
yeah.
It's not really God's.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. And I think it's still the helpful to see that. And I think it's also really fascinating to see Daniel, like Joseph. There's a lot of parallels between Daniel and Joseph, right? Joseph, who kind of goes and runs the Pharaoh's bureaucracy. Daniel and his friends, by the end of this chapter, are going to be doing the same thing. And it's really interesting to see God's people running pagan bureaucracies. But why do they do it? For the good of the people, right? There's actually a goodness that comes through that.
Because Nebuchadnezzar is obviously an egomaniac,
mm-hmm.
a loose cannon,
yeah.
and you know, kind of off with their heads mentality.
Yeah.
They don't do what he wants
yeah.
or he likes,
yeah.
and that changes every day.
Yeah, his whims, as and we'll see that especially in chapter 3 and 4. His whims are very capricious. Yes. All right. So verse 19. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Got our answer. Prayed, got his answer. It's wonderful. And then note this. Instead of Daniel running off and being like, great, I've got it. Let's book it to the palace. Let's do this earlier. What does he stop and do? He stops and praises God. Which, again, these aren't like, do everything like Daniel, but it is helpful to see this praise. It reminds me of the story of the 10 lepers, right? Only one goes back to Christ. The other 9 are like, just go do my life, right? Daniel is like this, that one leper who goes back to God. Note a few things in Daniel's prayer here as we reread it. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what he asked of you. For you have made known to us the king's matter. One translation renders that the king's dilemma. I like it. A couple things to note there. Back in verse 21, it begins by ascribing glory to God. But then he changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. It's just one of those helpful kind of reminders, and it really permeates the book of Daniel. In a sense, you can say God changes the kings like the seasons. That's sort of the implication here. It's fall. It's time for a new king. That's the rhythm here. God is the one who is in charge. God is the one who gives wisdom. And Daniel knows that, and I think that's why somebody earlier said he didn't panic. And I think that's why, because he knows this God. This God who sets up kings, who, as Psalm 2 says, right, channels the kings where he wants them to go. And so he declares God and his glory. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. The darkness, sort of the mystery, the unknown future. God knows that. And he is the God who has been always the God of Daniel and his people, right? He says, the God of my fathers. He's noting the generational aspect of this. And so he gives thanks. We could belabor that, but it's a really beautiful prayer, a beautiful psalm in the midst of this moment of crisis. Other things you notice there?
It's interesting that the phrase, wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't like he doesn't give wisdom to the fool. He could,
yeah.
but he's basically saying these people that already are yeah. wise, he's giving wisdom to.
Mm-hmm.
And those that already have knowledge and some understanding, he gives knowledge to.
Yeah.
So it's, I just thought it was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
People have to be prepared for this,
yeah.
and he doesn't just waste these things.
Yeah.
They can't appreciate it.
And that's a really good point. It sort of raises the question, what is wisdom, right? Because there is a sense here, God is giving wisdom. Sometimes we think of wisdom, right? If you just memorize the book of Proverbs, you're wise.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
No.
No. But why isn't it true?
To apply it.
Yeah, and I think we know that intuitively, but a lot of us, sort of our default in wisdom is, if I just knew Proverbs, like if I read Proverbs every day, then I'd be set, right? Now, if you read Proverbs every day, you'd be a lot wiser. Like that is objectively true. But there is a sense, oftentimes people talk about wisdom in the Old Testament with a sense of skill in the sort of the art of godly living is sometimes how people define it. And I think that's helpful in a little bit of what you see here, because Daniel doesn't just have book wisdom. He doesn't just know Proverbs. He also knows what it's like to live out wisdom in adversity, right? This is a very adverse situation. Think of Psalm 137. Psalm 137, it's, you can turn there, but it's not really important, but it talks about sort of being on the shores of the rivers of Babylon and weeping, right? And sort of hanging their harps up and being like, there's not even a point singing anymore. This is how awful it is. That's what it's like to be in exile. You're like, my homeland is gone. The place that I long for is gone. And yet the question then is, how do we live wisely in the midst of this? And Daniel is showing us that God hasn't left the scene, right? And that would be a real temptation, just like in our moments of crisis, it's a real temptation to say God has left the scene, right? Daniel is saying, no, you are not. You are still the God of my fathers. I give thanks to you. You have given me wisdom and might. Side note on all that. The language of wisdom and might and the other language earlier in here is the same words that Daniel will use to describe the king in a few verses. But it's, again, saying even the power and might of the king really comes from the God of Israel. All right. Go ahead.
One more point.
Yep.
Going back a few minutes to 17 and 18.
Yes.
One of the things I thought was important was Daniel didn't just pray.
Yeah.
He called his companions.
Yes.
His fellow, you know, believers, yeah, and shared them with the situation was,
yeah,
and then had them pray,
yeah,
with him.
Yeah. So Daniel's not alone. And that's right. A great point.
And
yeah.
So I think that's part of the work of the body, mm-hmm, is to support its members and a place for us to go and share things, yeah, and ask for prayer.
That's beautiful. Yeah, and I think it's arguable to say Daniel would not have been able to, we'll see that in other moments, do what he did without the help of his companions and his really friends. Yeah.
In 23, he acknowledges that. That was exactly what I was thinking. He acknowledges that, and he says, you have made known to me,
yeah,
what we requested of you,
yeah,
for you have made known to us,
yes,
the king's manner. He didn't just take all the glory for himself.
Yes.
He acknowledged that they were a body.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And there's another note. I don't think we've read it yet, but when he gives the interpretation, he uses we, and he says, we will tell you, right? And he's the only one there, but I think it's getting at exactly what you guys have noted there, the sense that he's not alone in this. Yeah. All right, verse 24. Therefore, Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said to him, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation. Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and said to him, I have found among the exiles from Judah a man who will make known to the king the interpretation. The king declared to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream that I have seen and its interpretation? Daniel answered the king and said, no wise man, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show to the king the mystery that the king has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the later days. Your dreams and the visions of your head as you lie in the bed are these. To you, O king, as you lie in bed, came thoughts of what would be after this. And he who reveals mysteries made known to you what is to be. But as for me, this mystery has been revealed to me not because of any wisdom that I have more than all the living, but in order that the interpretation may be made known to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your mind. All right, what is Daniel at pains to tell him there? He kind of says it three times. It's not me, right? It is God. Which is sort of, there's a function, it's sort of some humor in the text, right? Because what does Arioch come and do? He says, like, guys, I found it. I've got this. I found the guy. We don't have to kill everybody. I have found. It's like, no, you didn't do anything, right? Daniel came to you both times and said, I found it. Can I go talk to the king? And so, you know, the typical, that's expected from Arioch. He's trying to jockey for position. That's fine. But Daniel shows true humility and realizing that this is a position, right? There could have been some real temptation on Daniel's part, right? To sort of say, I could play this one a little close to the chest, right? I could just sort of give the interpretation and maybe get into the king's good graces. And later on, I could sort of maybe quietly share about Yahweh, right? He could have done that. Right, but he doesn't. He leads with the fact that it's like, there's actually a better God than your God, and I serve him. Yeah.
He also echoes what the wise men told the king, that there's no man
right.
who can give his, it's yeah. only, they said gods in heaven.
Yes.
And he says there's one God.
Absolutely, yeah. He's acknowledging that this is not a human source for any of this, which I think is helpful. What else do you notice in this part?
I thought it was interesting when you kept hammering home, I'm going to tell you what was in your mind, mm-hmm. what was in your mind, your thoughts. I'm going to reveal your thoughts to
yeah.
you.
Yeah, it is interesting. Yeah, and we might expect, even like that last verse as I was reading, I was like, our expectation would be like, so that God gets the glory, right? Which is ultimately where we're going. But he's very much saying, King, you need to know this, right? And that's an interesting point, what we make of that. I mean, it can be God is going to use Babylon towards his end, so maybe he wants Nebuchadnezzar to be confirmed in what he's doing. But there's a sense that it's for the king, right? Yeah. All right. Now we've gotten most of the way through this chapter and we still don't know what the dream was, don't know what it was about, but we're going to get there. One other thing to note here is, again, just the futility of other options, right? If you're thinking of applying this, the futility of other options besides God is sort of hammered home again in here. It is only God who can help us in these moments. All right, Daniel interprets the dream, verse 31. You saw, O king, and behold, a great image. The image, mighty and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of his image was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. As you looked, a stone was cut out by human hands, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them into pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold all together were broken into pieces and became like chaff of the summer threshing floor. And the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream. All right, so people have had fun trying to figure out how this image looked. These are from the 12th and 13th century. People tried to do that. This is a Bible illustration. And so people, were visual, and so they try to come up with images of how this all looks. Now people with AI come up with really cheesy graphics like this. Right, but like that's sort of what's happening, right? I pulled it up because it's like, well, that's sort of fair. You have this image, and a big rock comes and just destroys it, right? So what do we make with this? So here's the vision, here's the dream. And most of us are still saying, okay, what's the deal with that? And we'll get into the interpretation in a minute. It is interesting to note, right? Like he's on the money. It's like, this is what you saw. And the king seems to be okay with this. He's not debating with him and saying, well, that's not quite right. It was a different entity or whatever. What do you notice in the dream?
Well, the different materials are different materials that were used in the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And so is this pointing to idolatry?
It could be. And there, images and idolatry are going to come up majorly in the next chapter. Those things kind of held together. So, again, I guess sitting with it, and we'll get to the interpretation in a minute, but even as we hear that, we would have some questions, right? You're a king. You've had this image in your mind. It's falling apart. You see all these different things. It's questionable what this is about. We're no farther along. We do see sort of the top is more glorious than the bottom, right? You can kind of see that. Like gold is better than clay, right? That's something you notice. Some big cataclysmic thing is going to come in and destroy it all. There's a few things that you notice, but we're still largely in the dark. All right, so let's pick up.
You're probably wondering, am I the stone or am I the...
Yeah. Is this good news, bad news?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Clearly something... is changing. Clearly there's a big event coming, right? But who am I? Do I get to be the stone? Do I get to be gold? Where do I fit in this? And, all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
The other thing that strikes me is that the weaker materials are undermining the strong ones.
Yeah.
In other words, you're striking the foundation, so the ones that are stronger are in jeopardy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know what that means.
Yeah, these are good anticipations. Let's keep reading. I realize we're shorter on time than I thought. This was the dream, verse 36. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. Finally, You, O King, you, O King, the King of Kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power and the might and the glory. Little bit of flattery before we get going, right? Now, King of Kings was a Babylonian term, something they would have used, but he's not sort of demeaning Yahweh as the true King of Kings. He's not doing that, but he is playing the game, so to speak. Verse 38, and into whose hand he has given wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, making you rule over them all. You are the head of gold. That's a good dream, right? You get to be king. You're the head of gold. An other in kingdom inferior to you shall arise after you. And yet a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And there shall be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes it shall break and crush all these. And as you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom. But some of the firmness of iron shall be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with a soft clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. As you saw the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage, but they will not be held together, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. Just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. A greater God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and his interpretation is sure. All right. Now, we have an interpretation. Now, most of us are like, I want an interpretation of the interpretation. Yeah. It's like, I get what you're saying, but I want more. And that's fair. And so two things to kind of note here. One is we do have, in a sense, more. We've seen history sort of go by. We've seen God reveal himself in history as time has gone by. And so it's easier for us to sort of piece together what's going on. The other thing, though, to note is that in some sense, all the details aren't super important in the interpretation. We're gonna do some work and kind of see what kings are talked about in these different stratas of the image. But what's the big point here?
It's all destroyed and goes away.
Yeah, that there is a bigger kingdom coming, right? That is going to grow up and sort of be the kingdom, right? That's the big point. And there's a sense, like somebody said, like Dave, I think you said, that the foundation is weak, right? There's a sense that all of this is sort of going from glorious to less glorious, right? There's a trajectory, right? And so as we do this, the big picture here is to draw out the big implications of what's happening in history rather than saying, all right, from this decade to this decade, this king's in charge. Like, that's not the big point. The big point is that there is this coming kingdom. So what do we do with this? Who are the kings? Well, it starts out very easily, right? Who's the head of gold? Babylon, right? That's the clear point, and the last point is clear as well. Who's the last king?
Christ.
The kingdom of God's kingdom coming in, right? God coming in, to even quote Acts 4, right? The stone that becomes the stumbling block has sort of crashed into the scene and changed everything. And so we have some comfortability there. I think my computer just died. Between those two things. And that's good for us, right? There is some clarity then in the bookends of the story. And those are the big things. And so the two most common views of how to interpret this are that Babylon is gold. Next up, you have sort of the silver, right? And that's sort of the Medo-Persian Empire. Then you have bronze, which is Greece. And then you have sort of iron, which is the iron clay is one kingdom, and that is Rome. That started strong and then sort of splintered out. That's historically how lots of people have interpreted it. Some people will split the Mede and Persian Empire and then have the last one being Greece, because Greece sort of, you know, after Alexander the Great sort of fell apart. We could go different ways, but that's the trajectory that people have gone. There are different views within there. I think the big point, the big purpose there, again, and I think why sort of seeing it as Babylon to Rome makes sense, is that when does the kingdom of God sort of come and when is it inaugurated? When the Romans are in charge, right? And that makes sense, that sort of seeing that power of Christ come in and push out all other nations is really where this is going. Now, as we say that, that's what we take out of it. What is Nebuchadnezzar taking out of it? Is he happy or is he sad? It's interesting. People actually debate this point.
Should be happy, I would think.
Yeah.
He's the king. He's the head.
Yeah.
Your gold.
Yeah, it's like your gold. And I think that's how I read it. Some people, though, will read it and say, well, it also means that his kingdom is going to be short-lived, right? Because even gold is going to go to silver pretty quickly. But Nebuchadnezzar, as somebody said earlier, is pretty much he's full of himself enough that he's okay with things probably being really bad after him, as long as they're good for him, right? It's like, it was good for me. I don't really care. It can suck after that, and they can look at their lives and say, if only Nebuchadnezzar was still king. Like, he's full enough of himself that I think he's okay with that. So I think he takes this as good news. And in doing that, he misses the whole point, right? He misses the point just to say it's good now. It misses the whole reality that this thing is saying, that human kingdoms ultimately have no lasting power, right? As Daniel prayed back in the prayer, he changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. Nebuchadnezzar forgets that. And that's going to become a theme through the rest of the book, right? Nebuchadnezzar is going to go crazy at one point and all that sort of stuff. And it's going to be because his pride sort of elevated him to the sense of saying, I'm the head of gold. Look at me. And so he's missing the point even as he celebrates. The reality is that God's kingdom comes in and is better than all other kingdoms. What else do you notice? What other questions do we have?
Well, there's another material. It's stone. Mm-hmm. Stone mm-hmm. is cut by no human hands
yeah.
in a mountain.
Yeah.
And then it becomes a mountain that fills the earth after
yes.
it's done what it needs to do.
Yes. That's absolutely right. Of no human hands, which I think is actually an intentional, like that's mm-hmm. it's supposed to say, well, this is divine. Something is mm-hmm. coming. And what's also interesting is verse 35. If we go all the way back there, the stone struck the image and became a mountain and filled the whole earth, right? There's destruction here, but it actually leads to something that is good, right? The destruction isn't just, now it's a wasteland. This mountain grows up. Isaiah 2 talks about sort of the mountain of the Lord. I think we can draw some connections there. The mountain that comes in is not simply just a rugged mountain, but it's this place of life that people flock to. That's how the kingdom of God is often presented. We can read some prophecies together. And so really this shapes how we view history, right? We're given here a whole picture of history. Even though most of this is ancient history, we live in the reality of this new kingdom, this new mountain that is here, right? And we know there's the tension of the already and the not yet. This is already true. God's kingdom is here, and yet it's not fully realized. And so there is that tension as we read it. But this is an invitation to actually see the world as it is. No human hand has made this kingdom. It is the kingdom of God. And as he comes in, all is really at rest. As this new kingdom comes in, it is right and good. So what do we do with that? One very simple application is not to be impressed by political powers. Don't be impressed by them. Babylon fell. It's interesting, Assyria doesn't even get noted, right? Who is arguably a much more significant nation nationally. Like, it just preceded Babylon, much longer, much more powerful than Babylon, doesn't even get noted in history. It's already history. And so too, all of these nations have risen and fallen. And so it's really easy in a moment to be captivated by power. Right, and that was a temptation of Daniel. In this seat of power, in Babylon itself, he could have very easily said, this is awesome. Look at all the things I can do. This is going to make good things. I can run the government in a way that's going to change everything, all those sorts of things. But there's a realization that it is God behind all these things. So don't be overly impressed by political powers. There's also a sense, and I don't think we need to read too far into this, that there is a progression from good to bad, right? And the point is there not to say, well, everything's just always getting worse. That's not the point. But it is a sense to say human history and human kings continually disappoint. They went from gold to clay, right? And that pattern, that good to bad, just kind of keeps going on. And then a sense that we live in the middle of this. We live in the middle of all of this sort of confusion, and yet our eyes are on this rock, so to speak, that comes in and breaks into God's kingdom. Let's read these last verses. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and paid homage to Daniel and commanded that an offering and increase or an incense be offered up to him. The king answered and said to Daniel, "Truly your God is God of gods and Lord of lords and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery." Then the king gave Daniel high honors and many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and the chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. Daniel made a request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the provinces of Babylon. But Daniel remained in the king's court. All right, what has happened? Again, should remind you of Joseph. Here you have the exiled Jew who's now the prime minister, who's now the president. He's now in charge of everything. And so it's saying, in this moment where we think everything's going to run off the rails, that God's done with his people, the exile has ended everything, here we have God coming and bringing a king underneath him and placing Daniel here in this position of power. I think it's really easy for us to read this and say, of course that's what happens, right? Because we read the Bible. We know that that's what God does. But think for a moment how, like, concerned God's people are in this moment. Think about history for a moment. If we go back, the Assyrian nation, who was just before Babylon, came and they took out the 10 northern tribes, right? Like, took them out. They're gone. They never come back, right? Those are God's people, and, like, they're scattered, and they never come back to the promised land. Like, that's in Daniel's mind. That was a couple hundred years ago. And he knows, and sort of the sense is, like, this is next. We're next. Judah is next, right? And so for this to happen is remarkable. It's a remarkable reality of what? That God is faithful, that his covenant endures, that he is not going to abandon his people. And so we need to see the degree of threat to see the amount of hope that they have in this moment. And so we now have this man elevated. And again, Nebuchadnezzar, maybe he's worshiping Daniel, maybe he's not. It was common to sort of worship somebody as you're worshiping their God, sort of in that regard. But really he is acknowledging, in a sense, that Yahweh is a God. It's not yet to the point of sort of a confession of faith. Daniel or Nebuchadnezzar hasn't repented and become a follower of Yahweh at this point. But it is a reminder that even this powerful king has learned that he needs to bow the knee to the true God. And the question for us as we read that is, do we do the same? Do we do the same in the moments in our lives where we are concerned? Thoughts, questions, comments? What do we do with this?
Well, it kind of gives God's view of history,
mm-hmm.
that nothing's going to last except him and his kingdom.
Yeah. He's the ultimate. Yeah, he's in control.
I went and looked at the timeline because all that stuff. And this happened right around 600 BC, mm-hmm. maybe a little earlier. Rome was founded in, I think it's 509 BC. I can't add, so I usually remember the number. And I think Alexander the Great was like 330, mm-hmm. something like that. And so all of these things happened. So Rome was actually founded way before it became super powerful.
Right, yeah, yeah.
The city was founded in 509, is the big thing. But this all happened in that was only 100 years later that Rome, the city, was founded. And so all of this stuff is going to be happening in pretty short order. And then we've got the 400 years of silence, and we have the Maccabees, and all that stuff all going on in this time.
Yep.
And I think it just blows my mind,
yep.
that he knew these four major empires were coming.
Yeah. Yeah, I would, to your point, right? And so I said there's two views on the things, right? One sort of begins with Babylon and ends with Greece. The other one begins with Babylon and ends with Rome. That's sort of the classical view, and I think it makes the most sense. People have objected to it, right? Because Rome wasn't a big enough power in this day for anybody to predict that would have happened, right? And so people reject the Roman view because it's like, well, it's not prophecy. Like, that's sort of the liberal non-believer view on this passage. But to your point, right, God knows all of these things. He is in control of all of them. Let me end with this. I was going to have it on the screen, but technology didn't like that. So this is from a commentary by a guy named Dale Ralph Davis on Daniel, and he's telling a story from church history. He says this: the Roman and Christian-hating Emperor Julian, who was AD 322 through 363, was mortally wounded in a war with the Persians. While Julian's expedition was in progress, one of Julian's followers asked a Christian in Antioch what the carpenter's son was doing. Sort of a jab at him, right? What's your carpenter's son? What's this Jesus guy doing in the midst of all these world events? The Christian replied, "The maker of the world, whom you call the carpenter's son, is employed in making a coffin for the emperor."
He didn't want to live long, did he?
And then this, within days, news came to Antioch of Julian's death. That is where Daniel 2 leaves us. Jesus has a coffin for every emperor and empire. The only true security is in the kingdom of the carpenter's son. Now, there may be some historic hyperbole in that event. Who knows exactly how that was received? But the spirit is I think, where Daniel 2 takes us. That God is the only one who's in control. And that, you know, I think we all hear that, and we are so comfortable that it makes us a little bit afraid because we don't want to lose comfort. And I'm not here predicting the fall of the American empire or anything like that. But if God tarries, that will happen. It will happen. Nations recede. That is a reality. And so that reality that the only true security is in the kingdom of the carpenter's son is should be enough for us. And when it's not enough for us, when that makes us fearful, often it's our own idolatry, I think, that's at play and getting in the way. And we'll explore that more. Yeah?
I was just thinking about what we learned in 2 Peter about God just not being slow about his promise.
Yeah.
You know, and it just seems like these things go in cycles and on. And just a reminder that God is still at work and active, and he will work all these things out in his due time, you know. I mean, it's been a long time in human since this time, since Daniel, but he's still
doing it, yeah. And it's And I think that part, right, the next part of that passage is, as some count slowness. And all of us put up our head and say, I count it that way, right? Like, all of us do that. We're only going to really do the first half of Daniel, but in Daniel 11, it also says this, for talking about some of God's promises, it says, for it still awaits the appointed time, right? And so even in Daniel, there's a sense of waiting, right? And that's so much of what the church is. It's waiting. Even with the new kingdom, the new rock that has sort of broken and changed everything. And so Daniel, in a sense, is about waiting faithfully. How do we do that well? And the Jeremiah 29, you know, seeking the welfare of the city is part of what he does, but always remaining true to the God who has called him and stayed there. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for your word. Lord, as we looked at this, Lord, we are grateful for your word. We're grateful for your instruction. Lord, would you make us faithful? Would you help us see that you are the one who is in control of all things, that is